from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Robin Oliveira, whose new novel is Winter Sisters, just out from Viking. Robin Oliveira is the New York Times bestselling author of My Name is Mary Sutter and I Always Loved You. She holds a BA in Russian and studied at the Pushkin Language Institute in Moscow. She received an MFA in writing from Vermont College of Fine Arts and is also a registered nurse specializing in critical care. She lives in Seattle, Washington. Her new work is Winter Sisters. New York, 1879, after an epic snowstorm ravages the city of Albany, Dr. Mary Sutter, a former Civil War surgeon, begins a search for two little girls, the daughters of close friends killed by the storm, who have vanished without a trace. Mary's mother and niece, Elizabeth, who has been studying violin in Paris, return to Albany upon learning of the girl's disappearance. But Elizabeth has another reason for wanting to come home, one she is not willing to reveal. Despite resistance from the community who believe the girls to be dead, the family persists in their efforts to find the two sisters. When what happened to them is revealed, the uproar that ensues tears apart families, reputations, and even the social fabric of the city, exposing dark secrets about some of the most powerful of its citizens, and putting fragile loves and lives at great risk. Robin Oliveira and I began our conversation by discussing the blizzard itself, which is based on an actual 19th century storm. I asked Robin how she had learned of it and how she chose to depict it in Winter Sisters. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
You know, that's interesting. I actually can't remember the origin of why I inserted that blizzard, but when I understood that there would be two girls somehow set adrift, I think that I finally just had to I had to figure out a way that would be sort of out of their control, and I started to look at the weather data at the time and discovered that blizzard in 1888. Mm-hmm. Sometimes those connections are tenuous for me, you know, to remember exactly why I did something like that.
Okay. I figured you probably ran across it in your research, but I wondered if you were looking for it or if you just stumbled across it.
No, I wasn't. I was not looking for it. Okay. I think I stumbled.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the book begins with us. Do you mind if I read the opening sentence?
Oh, sure.
So this is the sentence that starts the book. 2 days before Emma and Claire O'Donnell disappeared, a light snow fell from the dawn sky above Albany, New York, almost as a warning mist. I thought that was a great opening sentence, and it made me wonder if we could talk a little bit about how you like to open your novels and what you think succeeds as an opening.
You know, Ivan Doig once said that you'll rewrite your first line 100 times. And I probably did rewrite that first line 100 times. And it comes from a desire to foreshadow and to also give a sense of the aboutness and the stakes of the novel. And so when I finally understood that how much impact the blizzard was going to have on the novel and on the lives of the girls, I was then able to think about what would draw in the reader the most and what was at stake and what was going to happen. And I reworked it and reworked it and reworked it and finally came up with that, which I liked. I liked it a lot because, you know, what happens to Emma and Claire O'Donnell is central to the novel. There's no novel without that moment of them disappearing.
Right, yeah. And I loved that... it's sort of the dawn sky, which is sort of like it heralds a beginning and opening, but then the warning mist, it's just a kind of wonderful message to the reader in addition to whatever information it conveys. So I thought that was really well done.
Well, it's a nice juxtaposition, I think, between, you know, light snow, that's always so pleasant, right?
Right.
In that age of, no forecasting. They had no idea that the blizzard was going to come. You know, then later you look back, you know, the characters look back and say, yes, you know, the blizzard was going to happen. But then characters would have been taken unaware and not known that what was greeted as a beautiful spring snowstorm, in fact, turned out to be devastation.
Yeah. Now, the characters in this novel, some of the characters in this novel appeared in your first novel, My Name is Mary Sutter. So can you talk a little bit about bringing characters back into a subsequent novel?
Yes. I didn't actually initially decide to bring Mary Sutter back. That's not why she appears in this novel. I wasn't thinking I need another Mary Sutter novel, although as I traveled the country and as readers have written to me, they all say, please write another Mary Sutter novel. We like her. We want to spend time with her. But I could never actually think of any good reason to bring her back. I mean, the cataclysm of the Civil War in which she's involved in the first novel, there just simply wasn't anything that I knew of that was as dramatic. It seemed to me that any story that included her would be, it would be just anticlimactic and not as interesting. When I started to write this novel and started to explore what would happen to these two girls, I knew that a woman physician might be needed.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, since it's set in Albany, New York, who else do you call but Mary Sutter? And I thought, well, she'll just have a little cameo. But then that didn't make any sense because when she discovers about what happens to these girls after they disappear, I couldn't imagine her being anything less than full throttle involved.
Right.
So that in particular is why she came back. But bringing back a character is a little tricky, because, especially in this one, there's 12 years between the end of Mary Sutter and the beginning of this one. And you have a whole entire life, you know, 12 years of time to encapsulate for them to grow and to change their situation and to form new attachments and to have just, you know, started other projects. And so I had to figure out what happened in those 12 years to Mary Sutter and the people and the other characters in order to make a new novel that could stand alone.
Yeah.
It was tricky.
Now, why 12 years? Why was the time period important enough that you had to do that?
Because I needed my characters to be a certain age.
So
that's why I moved the 1888 blizzard
right.
to 1879, because I needed my characters to be a specific age.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, great. Do you think that Mary Sutter will be back in any of your other novels?
I don't know. Everybody always asks. As soon as they finish reading this book, they say, well, when's the next one? And I think I can envision one more.
Yeah.
At the end of her life, I think it's possible, but I'm going to take a little break from Mary Sutter for the next one.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Now, without going into too much detail about what happens in this book, I will say that one detail that really struck me, and I just couldn't believe it, was that the age of consent for a child, for a woman, I guess, until 1886 was 10 years old. That just really just disturbed me so very much. Why do you think that was ever established?
Well, I think there could be myriad reasons for it. It was a patriarchal society.
Mm-hmm.
Men controlled everything. Women didn't yet have the vote. There was no opportunity for most women to achieve anything outside of the home. I think it's possible, you know, in Delaware, the age was 7.
God.
And I think that there, you know, much as you see or you read about in Pakistan, places like Pakistan and India, that, you know, they're having trouble feeding the entire family. So if you can marry one daughter off, even if you don't want to, then you're relieved of the burden of feeding them. And in that era of having many, many children, because there's no birth control or not widely available birth control, then you end up with so many children that you can't feed them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that all those factors contribute to that particular circumstance.
Mm-hmm. And then it sounds like the law finally changed in 1886. You do mention at the end of the book a little historical information for us to take in. So that at least happened.
Yeah, that happened before women got the vote, which is interesting.
Mm. Yeah. Now, I wondered if any of the characters in this book are based on actual historical figures.
Oh, yes. I really like to bring in people of the time. It gives me, I don't know, it sort of makes me feel like my characters are actually living. My fictional characters are living in that historical milieu.
Yeah.
So there's a coroner involved, and his name is Dr. Starkweather.
Oh, yeah.
And it takes place during the blizzard, and you would think I made that up, but I didn't make that up. That was actually the coroner's name in 1879 in Albany, Dr. Starkweather.
Oh, funny.
There is the judge is the judge who would have presided over the Court of Sessions at that time. I'm trying to think who else is historical. I sprinkle them in. Oh, and all of the members of society.
Oh, right.
With the exception of the Vanderveers. So those are all historical names from old Albany. And, you know, I grew up in Loudonville, and I knew some of their descendants.
Oh, wow.
So it's a way of sort of signaling to Albanians that I've taken their history seriously and brought in some of their luminaries and set my other characters loose in that time period.
Now, do you then have to be careful? Like, do you research names and make sure that you don't have any antagonists who have names that might resonate with anybody?
Well, I am careful not to play fast and loose with anybody's real life. So I don't turn somebody who was an upstanding village, upstanding citizen into a villain for my creature happiness for yeah. writing this story. So I'm really, really careful with that. That said, there is a character in the book named Vanderveer, and there were Vanderveers then, and I didn't discover that really until midway through the novel. So then I did include one historic Vanderveer and gave him his full history.
Yeah.
But while making sure that I didn't use his first name and villainize him when yeah. he didn't deserve it.
Right. Okay. That's good. Now, I wonder if we can talk a little bit about the research that goes into writing a book like this, or like all of your books, really. You have just such incredible details. And I know you used to practice as a nurse, but you, like one of the details was that the survivors from the Civil War, even if they had legs amputated, they may later die from infection because the wooden legs were so destructive to the remaining limb. So little things like that. I didn't know that. Maybe that's something that people in the medical profession just know. So I was going to ask you, what were your best sources for this historical information? And also maybe what was something that you looked for that was really hard to track down?
So I looked in various places. So for instance, the medicine after the Civil War and what was going on, I was sort of a holdover from My Name is Mary Sutter. There exists this extraordinary compendium of all the cases that physicians followed after the Civil War. They did extensive research. And so I was able to read, they followed these patients for 20, sometimes 30 years. So you could see what happened to each type of wound after the Civil War, how that was taken care of. So I was able to authenticate the medical stuff that way.
Mm-hmm.
The other things, the laws and the statutes, I ended up calling the Albany Law School a lot and the librarians there to ask them to help me figure out exactly what the statutes were then, how they would have been applied. Some of that was very difficult to find, and I rely a lot on librarians to mm-hmm. help me hunt down some of these things.
Do they mostly seem happy to be given this sort of like piece of information to track down? I mean, that is probably what they enjoy doing, I'm guessing.
They do. They love it. I have never had anybody rebel. They're gracious and generous with their time. And partly, I have a publishing track record behind me, so they know I'm not just someone who's saying I'm writing a book.
Right.
But I have discovered that if you tell people you're writing a book and you seem pretty serious about it, librarians especially are research fanatics, and they're extremely happy to help. And then, of course, I always thank them in the author's notes afterwards in the acknowledgments.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's always been a very pleasant, wonderful experience for me.
I want to talk about a scene. There's a wonderful scene in the book that depicts a dinner party. And to me as a reader, the conversation sort of achieves two things. First, it really gives this great time and place, this sense of the time and place at this point in this point in society. It shows class distinctions really well and also a certain sense of just accepted misogyny. But then the other thing that it does is that there's all this boring chatter around the table. And in the previous chapter, we have learned something very suspenseful about what has happened to these missing children. And so it just really builds suspense to go from that information into this dinner party that's just sort of, you know, I don't know, chit-chat around the table. So I wondered if we could talk about that, about writing that scene, but also just talk about building suspense in a novel.
Yes. So that particular dinner scene, you know, I had a dear friend who died very young, and one of my clearest memories that still stays with me is that waking up the next day and seeing that life went on without her. Life still went on. And there was that sense as I was writing that scene at the dinner table, was that somebody important had died, and yet, you know, it was sort of a matter of course, and the people who were alive paid very little attention to it. So there was that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, you know, being in terrible distress, you know, when we're in terrible distress, sometimes everything around us seems banal. So
yeah.
There's that
yeah.
sense. Mary and William are in terrible distress. Everybody in that family knows that something terrible, they've sort of gotten clues and they're concerned and worried, and yet they have to have this other social obligation.
Right.
But there's also that great sense of, you know, who knows what. We suddenly at that moment have a sense that some people at the dinner table know more than the Sutter Stips know. So there's that kind of tension that's underlying. And I discovered that was, I've never written a sort of a mystery, such a plot-driven novel before. I had to remember at any given moment who knew what.
Yeah.
Yeah, if the reader knows that some characters know something, but the other characters do not, that creates suspense all by itself, because you're wondering what's going to be revealed. Are the, you know, the characters that you're rooting for going to figure out what's going on, or is it going to be this, you know, are they just going to lose everything? So there's that sense that you can play with. But in addition, on top of that, they've learned something very suspenseful before this next scene. And delay is always a handy little tool, especially if you want to write a sort of a long epic novel. You give the reader this information, it's terrifying, and then there's a bit of a delay.
Mm-hmm.
And then you bring it up again. But you're still hinting at it, right? You know, characters know things, and that's still going on.
Yeah, that's exactly what that scene did.
Yeah, to dance. Yeah, to dance.
Yeah, yeah. Robin, do you mind, is it possible, I'd like to read a paragraph from the book and then we could talk about it. Is that all right?
Sure.
Okay. All right. So this is from Mary's point of view. She's talking to a policeman named Mantell. Though his tone was respectful, it was also patronizing, with an undercurrent of disdain. When people asked her about the war, they supposed that it had been a frustrating, awful experience. But in that lawless landscape, when she had wanted to accomplish something, all she'd had to do was take steps to get it done. Climb onto trains going in the direction of battles, talk her way through barriers, both prejudicial and material. In some cases, just show up until someone relented. And then I'm going to skip a little bit. Therein lay the advantage of wartime. Men were too busy killing one another to take heed of women's activities. But after the war, their general opinion of her turned. She wasn't quite respectable. Her ambitions were unladylike. At best, she was a curiosity. She was aware that many society women who asked for her help eyed her with the same suspicion, and people like Mantell felt free to lecture her about what she could and could not do. Sorry, that was kind of a long paragraph, but I found it really interesting. First, it just sort of like was interesting to consider the increased agency that women had then during wartime. which I think continued right through into like World War II when women were getting jobs when the men were away. But also just, you know, reading about the class distinctions and thinking about, you know, things that keep women from banding together, such as these society women who wouldn't have respect for her. So that was just a really interesting paragraph. And I wondered if we can talk a little bit about women and depicting women in the 19th century and what you like to do. What's your goal when you're writing female characters?
Well, I tend to write about breaking 19th century glass ceilings. It seems to be my evolving, you know, that writers are often preoccupied with one theme that sort of runs through all their books. And I've discovered over time that that's actually what interests me. And the reason it interests me is because it's, you know, women still have to break glass ceilings. They might be a little higher, but that's still going on. Women are still fighting for purchase. They're still fighting for a place in society that is equal. And we've seen that today and all everything that's coming out with Weinstein and everyone that has been fired in terms of the way women are regarded and treated. So when I write about women in the 19th century, I think there was still a spectrum of women and their ability to find agency. Mm-hmm. For many of them, they were still tied to house and home and husband rule. Every once in a while, one of them would break out and show the way, you know, so the suffragettes and that sort of thing. So I like to, because I like strong female characters, but Mary Setter is this sort of beacon to me of not only a courageous woman, but a courageous human being and morally devoted to doing what the right thing is, no matter what. How men respond around her. I like showing that, but also then showing a woman who may not even have that aspiration, not have an aspiration to break out, but nonetheless is suffering from the kinds of constraints that Mary fights against.
So I
think in all my novels you'll find that spectrum. And the first one in My Name Is Mary Setter, it was Jenny, Mary's sister, and Mary mm-hmm. in opposition. And in the second book, it was Mary Cassatt and Berta Moriso, who was a little more constrained by her times and her family. And then in this one, it's Mary and one of the other characters, Viola, who was constrained for many reasons. I like to write that spectrum because it provides contrast, and as you know, contrast is what propels the story forward when characters act.
Right, yeah. Yes. Now, I wonder, how was it writing a 19th century trial? There is a court, there is a series of scenes in the court, and you mentioned this before when you were talking about research. So how was it for you writing that?
It was difficult and exciting. I hunted down a bunch of 19th century trial transcripts. Believe it or not, they exist. They had court reporters then. They start at about 1881, 1883, which was close enough to my time of 1879 to make me think that I could probably use them. So I was able to find court procedure, and I was able to see how the opening statements were done and how the judge handled witnesses and how fast the trials went, much faster than they do today. So I had a kind of a template to work with, so I didn't have to make it up. Mm-hmm. But I sent my editors, the first draft of this book was 200,000 words.
Oh, wow.
Much of that was the trial, because I was trying to depict the trial absolutely sincerely and go through every single step that would happen with every single witness to depict it realistically, but that was really boring. And so
that's so interesting, because the follow on to my question was, how much legal detail did you feel compelled to include? Because that is what I think would be really hard. It's like, you, particularly if you're writing something that you're not super familiar with, you would be like really compelled to include every detail just in case it's an important one, right?
I did, and I could not see the forest for the trees. I just couldn't. And my editor just took her pen, literally, and went right through a bunch of stuff. She said, the reader already knows this. summarize. And that way I was able, you know, cut the dross, and that We went back and forth a little bit, and finally it boils down to this sort of succinct back and forth that I hope gives surprise and makes it move fast, but still we don't lose anything important that would turns the course of the plot. It was tough, yeah.
I thought it was very impressive because I just have always been intimidated by the idea of writing police procedure and courtroom procedure. It just feels like it's so outside of my, general understanding. So I thought you did it really well, and I thought it moved right along.
Thank you.
You're my first guest that I'm going to ask this of. I've asked it before, but I'm going to start asking this question of all my guests. I would really love if you could talk a little bit about the structural decisions you had to make in writing Winter Sisters. You know, sort of how and when you decided on the structure that you eventually settled on.
Well, I'll tell you how I structure my novels. I don't structure them from the start. I'm not thinking about structure. I'm following character desire, character movement, trying to make it exciting, going down rabbit holes to see what might happen if a character does this or a character does that. I give myself full rein at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, I realize that the whole thing has to hang together, more than halfway through. And I start to think about plot and subplot and how a subplot needs to mirror the plot, needs to contrast the plot. And that way you amplify theme and you amplify it, make it feel like it's about something very large. You know, you can make it seem universal. So that's running through my mind. But I follow that all the way through to the end. And I don't necessarily have what I would call a well-constructed novel when I'm done with my first draft, which, by the way, I have probably rewritten each chapter at least 5 times before I go on to the next.
Okay.
But what I do, and what I have done for every single novel I have ever written, is I use this book called Writing for Story. And in it, it's written by John Franklin, Writing for Story. I think it was published in 1981. So he won the Pulitzer Prize for creative nonfiction, for feature writing, for newspaper writing, just when that was sort of starting to be a thing. He won it twice. So he wrote a book about how he did that. And he generally he takes Aristotelian structure, and he makes an outline for you of how story moves. And the reason why this is helpful to use only after a first draft or after a draft, when you're pretty much sure you know what's happened in the story, is because you cannot generate story from it. Trust me, I have tried. You can't. I think you have to do all these movements and running down the rabbit holes to figure out where you're going. And what this does is it helps you sort of see what your story is. And then it starts with an overall major complication, what the conflict is. And then there are 5 movements underneath it for an epic, for a novel. You can make it just one for a short story, but for an epic novel. And you can see what the best way is to tell the story by, there's a major complication and then 5 movements underneath it where there's one complication, 3 developments, and then a resolution to that, but there's an interlinked complication that is the next complication that you move to, and then 3 developments. And what he's doing is following the emotional arc of the characters. Because, of course, what matters in story is not what happened, but why what happened. Why did the characters do that? That's why characters act, because they want something. They have some psychological needs, some physical needs, something that's driving them. And it helps you get down to that that deep subtext, that deep understory, that helps you look at what you've written and say, find the scenes that you're missing, and also see whether or not there's anything there that's of anything importance. Is that story moving along on an absolute, through line of drama that will carry readers all the way to the end and carry characters to the end and make that end about the beginning and still keep that middle part interesting? It is one of the most powerful tools I have ever used, and I tell everyone that.
That's fascinating. Now, do you start using it after you have a first draft, or you must already have it in your head as you're starting out? Is that...
No, I don't have it in my head when I start out. I started out this book basically with 1 fact, and that was that the age of consent was 10 years old, right?
Okay.
So I impose that structure after I've gone all the way through.
Wow. Okay. Now, so that sort of answers my next question, which was how much did you know when you began and how much did you allow yourself to plan ahead? So let me ask you this. And again, I don't want to give away anything that happens in the book, but this is a book that has quite a lot going on. At what point in writing it did you figure out the ending? Let's just do that.
Oh my goodness. Let me think about that. When I wrote it. It was a hard book to end. But I had to go back to Douglas Glover, who you know, who teaches at Vermont College of Fine Arts. When I was writing my first book, I got stuck one day. I was still calling him sometimes, asking him for help. And even after I'd graduated, he's a lovely gentleman. He's lovely. And he said to me, I said, I'm stuck. I don't know where to go. I don't know. I would go on these long walks and ponder. It was killing me. So I finally called him and he gave me one question, and it was, what does her soul want? And when I asked that of all my characters, I asked that as I write, but I asked that at the end, what mattered most to the character? And then that gives me the ending, and then I can write it. Because underneath, if you've been thinking about, you know, you write characters and then you get deeper and you get deeper and you get deeper and you finally understand what the character wants and what it's all about. And then you can find the ending when you ask, what does her soul want? What was most necessary to her to make this a hopeful, successful event in her life, which is, I think, what most people want to read about.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Robin, I wonder if you've read any books lately that you would recommend to listeners who love to read.
Well, I'm very fond of Amor Towles, A Gentleman in Moscow.
He keeps coming up.
I cannot get over that book. I think it's a wonderful, lovely book. I've read that recently. I read Love and Consolation Prizes, Other Consolation Prizes by Jamie Ford. That one's set in Seattle, so I think for those of us who live in Seattle, it's especially wonderful. And I've reread, every year, I reread Edith Wharton's A Custom of the Country. I think she manages to make a very unlikable character likable. And I also reread A House of Mirth, The House of Mirth, because I think Lily Bard is probably one of the most complex characters ever developed. You adore her and you shouldn't. She pulls a hat trick. I don't know how she does it. I'm still trying to figure it out.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Those are great. I wanted to ask you about the fact that you started writing. I think I read in an interview or in an article that you started writing in your 40s. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. Yes.
So then how long did it take you to sort of achieve, a certain level of proficiency, or maybe get your first story published, or what did you look at as your trajectory to where you started your career?
Well, I started writing when my son went to kindergarten, and my first book was accepted for publication when he was a freshman in college. So it was a long apprenticeship. And in that time, I started at the local community college doing evening writing classes. Then I moved to the University of Washington, extension classes, which were helpful. But then I ended up getting an MFA in writing at Vermont College, which was, for me, pivotal. In that time, I wrote a novel that got an agent but was rejected. And it was at that point that I thought, I absolutely am missing something. There's something I don't know. And for me, education is a great piece and in my life. So that's when I got the MFA. And so I graduated in 2006, and the novel was sold in 2009.
And in the meantime, you won the James Jones.
James Jones First Novel Fellowship, yes, for a novel in progress. And that was very helpful. I was actually on the verge of quitting because it seemed too hard. And then I won that award, which was extraordinary. You submit 50 pages of your novel, then they ask for 100. So you had to be kind of far along and a little bit polished to know exactly where it was. But I hadn't finished the novel by any means when I submitted. And I won it. And that was validation. That was the validation I needed to keep going.
And was that tied to publication or not?
I received, an excerpt was published in Provincetown Arts, which is connected with the James Jones Society, but there was no publication of promise of publication from the book. But what it did do was give me something I could put in my query letter for agents.
Yes. And that's a big, that's a big deal. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So, Robin, what are you writing now, if you can talk at all about it?
Well, I did take some time off at the end of writing this book because it was so exhausting. But I've just started now, and I don't like to talk about it because I generally ruin it when I talk about it.
Okay, so that's fine.
It will still be historical. I think it might take place in 1879. I'm still debating it might go up to 88. And at this point, it starts in Scotland and ends up in Seattle. So we'll see.
Yeah, now that presents, I've been working on something that takes place in two different, very, very different places. And that's its own thing. You know, to move a plot from one country to another. Have you started to find that at all yet or not yet?
I've spent a lot of time looking up steamship lines. I mean, just from the purely physical, how one would get from one place to another. But it's, you know, what it seems to me that it brings up then is for the immigrant in 19th century. I've been reading a lot of immigrant stories from the 19th century, especially Scott's stories. And it's this great sense of what is home. You know, that becomes the question, where is home and what is home? And it seems to me that if someone comes from another country and comes to this country, the kind of longing and aching that they have for home versus building themselves a new life brings up all kinds of conflict that you can use to propel a story forward. But you can't abandon the old country. It stays with the character forever, I think.
And where are you going for those immigrant stories to do your research?
Oh, lots of books published. I'm not in my office right now, so I can't give you a list, but there are many.
I just wondered if it was sort of internet research or book research or calling on librarians again or, you know, old letter archives.
All those things.
All right.
What's interesting is there's so much historical, a lot of historical letters are published. A lot of it is in academic books. So a lot of them are university presses and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. So, Robin, I just have one last question for you. I always like to end with some advice for writers. And in your case, you've written about war. You've described cities from our past. You've written about famous catastrophic floods and storms. And so I was thinking as we finish up, can you offer advice about writing setting and maybe particularly writing setting that you don't have direct access to? You can't walk outside and look at, you know, let's say Albany in 1879 or whatever. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. First of all, I grew up outside Albany, so I have memories of growing up there, which Albany wears its history on its sleeve, right? It's a lot of the architecture has persisted. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, apart from that, if you're going to write about anywhere, I make heavy use of old photograph archives. They exist online, they exist at university libraries, they exist in published art books. For instance, I'm looking at Glasgow, this extraordinary book from Glasgow, Scotland, where photographers took pictures of the closes and the narrow streets before they were torn down. Just the same way in Paris, I used an awful lot of the old pictures from Paris, so I make heavy use of that.
Mm-hmm.
I look at old maps, which are available online all the time, Library of Congress, the memory, American memory portion of the Library of Congress website is extremely helpful. I read old newspapers. I read descriptions of those old newspapers. The other thing is, in my first book, I didn't have, my kids were young, and I didn't have a lot of time to go out. I did go to the East Coast, and I went to Gettysburg, and I went to various places searching old historical sites for the first book, but I didn't have enough money to go back a second time, and I wanted to see the Antietam battlefield, but I couldn't because I didn't have the money, so I went on YouTube.
Oh, wow.
And the tours of YouTube on YouTube are amazing. I wanted to see the cornfield at Antietam, and I turned on a YouTube video of it, which was very helpful. So you can combine the old and the new and get a sense. We'll never be actual flies on the wall. We'll never be able to go back in time, but which is what I want to be able to do. But I do think it's possible to construct the old world by using all those various sources.
Okay. All right. That's great advice. Thank you so much. Before we say goodbye, I want to just mention again that the novel is called Winter Sisters. It's by Robin Oliveira, and it's published by Viking. Robin, thank you so much for speaking with me.
It was my pleasure, Sheila. Thank you so much.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author Robin Oliveira. We discussed her new novel, Winter Sisters, which is published by Viking. You can learn more about her work at robinoliveira.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to consider how it must have been to live before science allowed us to predict the weather. Sunshine or wind, ice, rain, write about unexpected weather. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you are interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest, like, you know, if you have heard about a book that you're dying to read, or you've read a book that you'd really love to hear an interview with the author, or if you have any comments about the show or suggestions, send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if I can, I will see if I can get in touch with that author and see if they might be available for an interview. Often I'm pretty fully booked in the moment, so it's great if you know that a book is coming out in like 3 months, and then you can ask me to try to get in touch with that author. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.